The Burrows of Berea is a conversational podcast.
We study the Bible and we talk about it.
Not all of us are of the same faith.
And one of us doesn't have a faith.
But we still love one another, and we're going to continue to talk about these things.
The things we believe in and the things we believe about what we read in the Bible. Not all of these are necessarily true. Some of it is opinion and speculation. Thank you for
listening and speculating with us.
There you go. That was good. Yes.
You are listening to the Burrows of Berea.
Hey, Burrows listeners, this is Andy. This interview was done shortly after the Eschaton 2025 conference held in Sydney, Australia earlier this year. Enjoy.
Well, I am here on Zoom, zooming across the globe. I watched this young lady, very smart lady, very informed lady, on the Eschaton 2025 conference. I took part in that conference. I spoke once, and we uploaded a video that I had done. But as I was watching, of course, I was wanting to watch Don, but then I saw this testimony of our guest that I've got on here today. And then she taught a lesson on Matthew 25, three parables in Matthew 25. And she even dove into the book of Revelation some. And I was really happy, and I was very surprised to see her. So we have our guest, Catherine Gavin from Sunshine Coast, Queensland. Hello, Catherine.
Hello. Hello, Rick. Hello to everyone listening.
Yes. So I've heard two funny things. I heard that Americans love the sound of an Australian accent, but I've also heard that some Australians like the sound of a Southern American. Have you ever heard that?
Yes. Yeah. It's
that country twang that we got down here.
Yeah. We probably try to imitate it sometimes. Fascinating to us.
Yeah, we try to imitate you guys too. I don't do too well with the Australian accent.
Oh, it's actually Australian accent is very hard to imitate, I've heard. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I wanted to introduce you to the audience because, first of all, there's a lot of people that don't feel comfortable with women teaching, although I do. In our podcast, we do have women that teach. People have sent me nasty grams in regard to it. And I've brought it to something that you and I both agreed on that we talked about, which is in this kingdom is a spiritual kingdom. And in this kingdom, there is neither male nor female, Jew nor Greek, nor bond nor free. And we know this. Mm-hmm. We know that if we were waiting on something that was coming in the future, then perhaps there could be a problem. Excuse me. But from our perspective of fulfilled eschatology, we're in that place now. There's nothing else to wait for. We're not expecting the parousia, right?
Absolutely. That's correct, yes. And in the spiritual kingdom, I believe all those within the kingdom are part of a spiritual priesthood. So we all have authority to share the word, no matter what our gender or our socioeconomic background or our race or nationality. We're all one together in that spiritual kingdom.
Yes, exactly. Do you have to be financially rich to do it?
No, not at all.
No, not at all. No. So not like in the days of Jesus. So, and that was wrong, by the way. That was corrupt. They weren't supposed to be like that. That was what Jesus went against for those that were looking for riches and the lovers of money at the time.
That's right. That's right.
So let's start with a question that may or may not be difficult for you, but let's just try it out, okay? So I ask every guest the same question. To the best of your ability, can you give me the earliest memory of when you heard the name Jesus Christ?
Okay, that is a difficult question. So my dad was Catholic. My mom became Catholic when she married him. And so I was sent to a Catholic school. And I know at a young age I was aware at least of the nativity story. So I was chosen to play the part of Mary holding baby Jesus in the school play when I was very young. So But at that point, I think Jesus was a mysterious background character to me. One of the things probably most impactful for me when I was young was my mother bought a series of Bible stories. And there were these beautiful hard-covered books with detailed illustrations. And she would ask us sometimes what we'd like her to read us at nighttime. And I would ask her to read the Bible stories because they just made me feel good. And so those stories were from the perspective of a child. For example, the little boy who brought the loaves and fishes to Jesus. They just really captured my imagination. But it probably wasn't until I was around 15 that Jesus really came to the forefront for me. Before that, like I said, he was just this mysterious background character. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whenever you, so being around Catholic, I know a lot of former Catholics that were raised, you know, Roman Catholic, that later entered into, say, the Baptist or the Methodist, sect, and believe, I guess that the idea here is that they became a true believer, a born again believer, as they would say around here. But I've talked to a few people from Australia that said that they were mainly raised just in a home of atheism or around, you know, the culture that was atheistic. Is that true? Is your culture around you more atheistic?
Yes, I would say, especially compared to America. Actually, my husband is a paramedic, and one of the questions he has to ask people is, do they have a religion? And he said the majority of people say no religion at all, which is interesting because he meets a vast amount of people through his job. So we have quite a lot of Pentecostal churches around, and what you consider, I guess, mainstream churches like Catholic or Methodist or Preterist or Uniting Church and those kind of things. But I'd say the majority of people really don't care much for religion. A lot of people are interested in Eastern type religions, I guess, like Buddhism. But on the most part, they'll say no religion, really. So quite different to America, yeah.
Yeah, that seems to be, like, where I grew up, there's a church on every corner, and I would say that predominantly people here would consider themselves Christian. And it's rare to be an atheist around here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very different. So I'm very curious now, so when Jesus came to the forefront, I've heard your testimony, but our audience hasn't. So I would like you to take me from that point. Take me to that point to where you're 15 and Jesus becomes the forefront, or comes to the forefront, and bring me up and go as long or as short as you want. Bring me up to the present, to the point to where a young woman is standing in front of a full preterist teaching eschatology.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So take us on the journey.
Okay. So when I was about 14, I became quite rebellious. My mother and father had went through a phase of taking us to the Catholic parish, but I complained, saying it was too boring, and lost interest in Catholicism completely. And then I went down this path of at school having a bit of difficulty fitting in and making friends and deciding I'm going to change my image and become this bad girl. And but then I began to feel really guilty about the track that I'd gone down. And it was right around that point that my mother asked me to accompany her to our neighbor's house. They had what they called a video ministry. And she said that she felt a bit shy to go along. So I said, okay, I'll go with you. And when I went there, I watched videos of people like Kenneth Copeland, Benny Hinn, Jesse Duplantis, which I'd never seen anything like that before. And I wouldn't watch those videos now because I don't agree with the doctrine.
Just so you know, We loathe them on the Burrows of Berea. We loathe
them. Oh, good.
We feel like they are taking advantage of all of our grandmothers.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I did think they were a little strange when I first came across them myself. But despite that, I was deeply impacted by my visit to my neighbor's house because I met people who talked about Jesus like they had a relationship with him. And I didn't even realize that you could have a relationship with Jesus. And also they read the Bible, which I had never seen that before. It was very foreign to me. And so I realized at that point that this is what I've been looking for. I wanted a relationship with Jesus. So Jesus came right to the forefront for me there. And it's like my eyes were opened, or I was awakened to Jesus. And I went home that night, and I remember all night long, it felt like I was just dreaming about God. Just God was so on my mind and just so all over me. But so those neighbors started a church group, which I began attending, and it was a Pentecostal group. Now, very soon after that, I actually went off to boarding school, and then I went to uni, so I was away from home, and unfortunately, you know, I got into some drugs and things like that. So it wasn't until I was 18 that I had a true crisis of conviction, because I was a bit of a walking contradiction. I was doing things that were wrong, but at the same time, I would occasionally attend a church service and I would try to memorize scripture. And eventually just the word of God just became so heavy on my conscience, heavier and heavier, until I couldn't hardly take it anymore. And I had a realization that I actually had to forsake my old sinful ways in order to be reconciled to God. I couldn't have a foot in both camps like I was trying to do. I couldn't love the world and want to experience everything in the world and follow Jesus at the same time. So I came to a very low point, a very broken point. I was a bit like, I guess you'd say, a wild horse that needed to be broken in. And I came to that point. I got rid of all my ungodly music that I was obsessed with, changed the way I dressed even. I used to wear a lot of black. I was a bit, you know, I guess I was a bit of an emo before there were emos. But
goth. They call it goth.
I've heard goth back then, yeah. Yeah. And I just began fellowshipping with Christian people as often as I could. And it's like God really started working when God could work with me then. And that's when God really transformed me into a new creature, in Christ. My desires changed and I was a different person. So that's when I was 18. So I was part of that church group. Like I said, it was Pentecostal. We had believed in all the typical Pentecostal doctrines, like speaking in tongues. We were quite charismatic. We were into the faith healing, being slain in the spirit, all that charismatic sort of stuff. And then this is around the time there was this Pensacola and Brownsville revival in America, which I don't know if you remember that. That was a long time ago.
Yes. But
things got a bit crazy.
Are you talking about in the 90s? Was this in the 90s?
This is the 90s.
Yeah, I remember that. I do remember it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's when my pastor began to question whether all this charismatic stuff was actually good. And it's also around that time he came in contact with a holiness pastor from North Carolina. Yes. Yeah, it's called, his name was Joseph Chambers. Don't know if you've ever heard of him.
I haven't.
No, okay. So he had a church called Poor Creek Holiness Church. And we became loosely affiliated with that group, and we actually started to call ourselves a holiness church.
Oh, okay.
So they were Pentecostal, but they said they were non-charismatic. And they had doctrines that I guess you'd say kind of Wesleyan type doctrines. such as you have to consecrate yourself fully to God, present your body a living sacrifice, acceptable unto God, and at that point you were positionally saved. But then you had to wait upon God to sanctify you. We believed in instant and entire sanctification. And then, and you would be, the Adamic nature would be purged out of you and you'd be filled with the Holy Spirit. And at that point, God's righteousness was imparted to you, not just imputed, but imparted. Anyway, these were the doctrines. And they also believed in what they called outward standards, such as women had long dresses, long hair, they didn't cut their hair, no makeup, no jewelry. So we sort of took on all of that and it paints a picture of what we look like. And I didn't cut my hair at all for 10 years, so it was pretty long. Wow. And that, yeah, and that I believed all of that. For me, so that the doctrines about being consecrated and sanctified dealt with something I'd been concerned with in the Pentecostal movement that I'd seen, where people would just sort of say a sinner's prayer, repeat after me, and then they'd be pronounced born again, and they hadn't even dealt with the sin in their life, and it just seemed a bit too quick and easy and not really genuine. So I was pretty embracing of that, those doctrines that were taught through the Holiness Church. So anyway, so I was about 20 when we became a Holiness Church. Okay, so later on, like when I was 26, I actually flew in a plane over to North Carolina and I went to a camp meeting at that Holiness Church.
You said that it was called Paul Creek?
Paw, P-A-W, Paw Creek.
Oh, Paw Creek. I'm going to look this up because I want to see how far away you were from me.
Yeah.
Paw Creek.
I even remember the street name was Tuckasegee Road.
Yeah, 5110 Tuckasegee Road.
Yeah, that's it.
And let's see where that is located. It's in Charlotte. It's an hour and a half from me here.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You were very close to us.
Yeah. Yeah, well, So I visited them in when I was 26. Then the following year, our church group in Caloundra, where I am, on the Sunshine Coast, was visited by a Canadian couple, and they called themselves Church of God. And they introduced us to some interesting ideas about the Book of Revelation. And my pastor started to communicate with Church of God people. And then we actually became a Church of God group.
Wow.
So we changed again. So now we didn't call ourselves Pentecostal anymore. We were non-denominational. In fact, we were anti-denominational. We were against all denominations.
So can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. Were you still using the gifts at this point?
Well, we slowly started to stop doing that sort of thing. I know in some church groups, even in a holiness church group, you have people that start speaking in tongues and then another person jumps out and interprets the tongues and that kind of thing. We didn't actually do that kind of thing. So We still believed in healing, but we didn't emphasize it. We certainly weren't doing things like being slain in the spirit or being drunk in the spirit and that sort of extreme stuff. Mm-hmm. We probably did believe that everyone in the body had a different gift that they would function in, like the gift of knowledge or the gift of healing or the gift of helps or whatever they were.
Sure.
Yeah, so we're still like that. But we were a bit of a mixture. Our church group was actually, we're very independent. My pastor was a very independent thinker. We were only ever loosely affiliated with anybody else. Yeah, but, and we kind of slowly evolved and changed over time and a lot of our beliefs. But, yeah, we became Church of God, so we had the same outward standards. But these Church of God people, they believed that with the book of Revelation that the seven seals or seven trumpets represented seven different periods throughout the gospel age or church age, whatever you want to call it, and that we were in the seventh trumpet period. And that
big shock. Yeah, that's so common. Everybody believes
is it?
We're in. Yeah, well, it's every church, especially in dispensationalism around here, believes that they're in the last days. And that's, to me, it's not surprising. It's what people do. We are that special generation, you know, is the way we look at it. But I know, you know, I was raised around that. We didn't think we were in the seventh trumpet. We just believed that we were waiting on the rapture to occur.
What if your self-help coach was your captor? What if empowerment meant obedience, and a colored sash meant you belonged to someone? This is the true story of Nexium, a personal development company that promised growth and delivered control. We're going inside the minds behind the headlines. Keith Raniere, the so-called genius who weaponized belief. Nancy Saltzman, the therapist who professionalized submission. And Allison Mack, the actress who helped brand women into silence. We'll hear from survivors, whistleblowers, and the families who fought to bring the truth to light. This isn't just a cult story. It's a case study in how ambition, psychology, and charisma can become chains. Listen to our new series of Sashes and Slaves, coming soon only on Patreon. Go to www.patreon.com/theburrowsofberea.
Yes, that's right. And I think when we were Pentecostal, we were waiting for the rapture. Yeah, and that was sort of a given. Like, how could you argue against that doctrine? That's how I felt at the time. Like, but yes, so with the Holiness Church, they put a fair bit of emphasis on Revelation, on end times, and for them it was all futuristic, completely futuristic. And then with this Church of God group, they had all these that seemed to work it out a lot more, and they were saying, okay, we were in the seventh trumpet period, and our job was to call people to come out from all their denominations into the one and only Church of God, and that there would come a point when the Church of God would be restored to its former glory, and I guess that would be the end of time.
I wonder what the former glory is, because from what I read in the scriptures, there never really was one. There was always division and problems, even in the first century. So what were they thinking exactly? What is the former glory? Do you know?
That's a good point. But I guess they're saying, like, initially after Pentecost.
Oh, okay.
When the church was first formed.
The first 3 weeks of the church.
Well, they believe that there was a falling away at some point. Certainly when the Roman Catholic Church was formed, that there was a falling away. And so that we were trying to get back to that former glory of the early church. Yeah.
Okay. Well, in regard to that, I can see that, to where it got away from the warmongers and the indulgences and the terrible things that the Roman Catholic Church brought, the Inquisitions and all that, to get back to when it was, before all that. Okay, that's fine. Like, I can accept that. They'd like to see that. That's fine.
Yeah. That was their take on it, and it really appealed to me at the time. Because I think most people, when you talk to them about how many denominations there are and all the confusion that there is in the church world because of all these different groups and sects, most people will agree that that's not really good. It probably shouldn't be that.
Do you happen to know how many denominations there actually are? I just researched this for a talk I'm doing in a couple of weeks. There's over 45,000. Different sects within Christianity. 45,000.
Oh my goodness, that's incredible. That's
cropping up overnight.
Yes. And they've all got their particular doctrine that separates them from everybody else and differentiates them. Yeah, so most people will agree that it shouldn't really be like that. There is a lot of confusion and division, that's for sure. And so that appealed to me, the idea of calling people to come out of their denominations into the Church of God. And except now I understand that these Church of God people incorrect in the idea that the church was being restored and that it would, you know, go back to its former glory and then the end of time would come. They didn't quite have that right, I believe. Now, so we were Church of God for a while, quite a while. And then actually my husband and I, because I met my husband in the church group that I was in, we ended up leaving that church group when I was 40 years old. So I was basically with them from when I was 15 to 40.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was a huge thing for me and for him. And I'm pleased that my husband and I were able to live together and that we've just been on this journey together in everything. I know I've heard other people's experiences saying that, you know, they're not quite on the same page with their husband or wife. So I'm thankful for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So was there anything in particular that made you leave when you were 40?
Yes. Oh, that's a bit of a story. Well,
now, if it's too personal or whatever, I don't need to do all that, but I mean, it was just curious what it might be. It's up to you. You can share whatever you want.
Yeah. Well, I just felt that, the dynamics were unhealthy. I've got to be careful what I say.
I understand. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll say in general terms, I don't like it when you have sort of like a pastor at the top and they have so much influence over their followers to the point where people just accept whatever they say and they'll marry people or not marry people or do things like that because of the pastor's influence. And that is, you're starting to get... I think unhealthy when it's someone has that much power over others.
The proper definition of that is called cult. That's what it is. It's cult behavior. It's yep, it is. You have behavior and information and thought and emotional control. And when you see that, that is the definition of a cult. And usually when you have a pastor that is wielding their power or having that much influence without any checks and balances, that's the sign. So it looks to me like you and your husband probably got out before anything really bad could have happened, I assume.
Some bad things did happen before that. Like, well, we were told not to get married, my husband and I. Mm-hmm. And so I called off the wedding. And then anyway, I'm getting into some personal things here. But we ended up getting married, obviously, like 4 years later, and I was seeing this pattern repeated of this sort of like level of control. I didn't feel comfortable with. I didn't think it was right. So anyway,
you made the right decision. You made the right decision for you, and your husband did too. That's wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So we got out of that when I was 40, and it was very like a big deal, really big deal to leave the group. I mean, I consider those people my family. So
well, yeah.
I felt quite, I felt, you know, quite lonely after leaving, quite disconnected.
Are they still disconnected from you?
Yes. Well, I might occasionally see somebody in town because we still live in the same town.
Yeah.
So very occasionally I'll bump into somebody and some of them I can talk to and have a conversation with, but I know that essentially we are disconnected because we're not in the same church group.
Yeah, you left and went to the wrong side of the tracks. You've crossed over most likely, and within that body, they will probably say that, I'm not going to say they're going to full on say you're heretics, but you're troubled. There's a problem, you know. You know, and that's the way that the congregation may or may not look at you, depending on their level of maturity.
Yes, yes. And I know that what happens, because I'd seen it happen many times before, is when somebody leaves, they get painted as they've fallen away, they were prideful, they were you know, all of these things get said about the person once they've left. And that never sat well with me, all these things being said about this person behind their back about how bad they are. But I'm sure all of that stuff's been said about me.
Sure. Well, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case. But I still think that you and your husband made the right decision, and that was probably the best thing you could have ever done, is get away from a high control group like that.
Yeah. Well, it was really, the problem is, when I was in that group, I didn't really study the Bible properly myself. I didn't feel the incentive to study the Bible because I was really reliant on the person behind the pulpit to feed me. So it's since leaving that group, I started to get serious about God and serious about actually studying for myself, and a whole new world has opened up for me.
You and I have something very much in common. We both fell in love with the Gospel of Matthew.
Oh, wow. That's so good. Yes.
I heard that in your talk, and I was like, yep, I'm right there with you. I love that gospel. I love them all, but the Gospel of Matthew, it's such an amazing, like, cohesive unit. It's wonderful.
Oh, I love God. Yeah, I love Matthew. That's, well, in all those 25 years I was part of that church group, I never understood Matthew. I never knew how cohesive it was and how all the chapters build up to the Olivet Discourse and explain the Olivet Discourse. Never knew any of that. There was so much I didn't know, I realized, over all those years.
And there's also, it should tell you how much that your pastor doesn't know as well.
About true.
That book, right? Never taught it. Never. You never were fed that. You were never taught that.
No, not in a cohesive sort of way. I mean, one thing he did say, and was true, was that the Great Tribulation that's spoken of in Matthew 24 was to do with the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. So those bits and pieces that were definitely true that he shared with us that he knew, but since coming out of that group, I'm understanding in a more complete and cohesive way. But anyhow, I left that group. I joined a Skype group that was facilitated by a lady called Sansha, and her husband was a YouTuber called Mike Desario, and he's now died. But so in that Skype group, they talked a lot about repentance proven by deeds, working out your salvation with fear and trembling, enduring temptation, living above sin, living above willful sin. Like, you'll make mistakes, but, you know, living a life that is above willful sin. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's what their emphasis was on, all that. And I learned a lot, actually, through them. And this was me starting to actually read the Bible for myself too, and becoming aware of more scriptures that I'd never taken notice of before. But they steered away from the whole eschatology thing. They weren't particularly interested in that because they thought that was really just a distraction from the main message they were trying to get across.
Right.
Yeah, so in about, I think, 2019, I started my own Skype group. And the idea was that we were going to study to show ourselves approved. We were going to, so we would each week study a Bible topic. And then eventually we moved to studying the epistles chapter by chapter. And that was so beneficial for me. I'd never done that before. And I gradually started to actually understand the context of each epistle, and then I began to see how the epistles were connected together. And it was wonderful. So my husband was in my Skype group, our Skype group, I should say, sorry.
Yeah.
And some Americans from Sansha's group came over to ours, and the Americans, most of them had come from knowing Mike Desario and his teachings. So that's kind of what we were united around. However, I knew that I had some different ideas about eschatology to what most of the people did on our Skype group. Eventually, I made a video. I didn't mention that I started a YouTube video. YouTube channel, sorry. YouTube channel in 2018 just to share.
I'm going to put your YouTube channel link in the show notes, guys. So if you want to go check out our YouTube channel, I've been looking at it. It's very fun and very informative. It's good. I enjoy it.
Oh, well, that's good. Yes. So that just started out with me just simply wanting to share the things that I was learning through my study. In about 2020, I put up a video about the New Jerusalem because I had a particular fascination in the New Jerusalem. And in that video, I said that it was a present spiritual reality, not a literal physical building that was going to descend from the sky in the future. And I felt like that was a controversial video that I didn't know if my subscribers would like it or not. But it got the attention from a couple in Texas, and they contacted me and they wanted to join our Skype group. Actually, I think we changed to Zoom by that time. But anyhow.
Yeah.
And so we were studying through 2 Peter 3 when they joined us.
Well, that's a good one.
2 Peter 3. And then we started from there. We started talking a bit about Matthew 24, and I became aware that they believed in fulfilled eschatology, even though actually I wasn't familiar with the word eschatology back then. I didn't know what that word meant.
Right.
But
so they believed. Can I ask you a question right quick before you go too far? So your own personal studies led you to fulfilled eschatology. Did you have any other books or any other influences that you had come across? Or was this just you studying this and you were like, you know, I believe that this is fulfilled?
No, it wasn't just on my own. Well, under my pastor, he actually taught us, first of all, that Jesus had already come back. He taught us that. However, he said that he came back and married the church at Pentecost. And so I believe that. And I believed that the Great Tribulation was something to do with the temple being thrown down as well. So I had some pieces of the puzzle, like back then with him, but some pieces were missing and some were misplaced. It was all a bit confusing. So then this Texan couple came on, and it was particularly the lady named Elise Campert is her name. She, as we studied through the epistles together, she brought things to my awareness. She brought a lot of Matthew. We're talking about Matthew before. She actually showed me how Matthew was so cohesive and so wonderful, and the way that it all explained the Olivet Discourse. And I mean, it was wonderful how it just unfolded, because we were actually studying through the word together. So I was seeing it for myself and I was coming to the understanding myself, but she was sort of bringing it to light for me and kind of guiding me, I guess, mentoring me and my husband, basically. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I could totally see it. And sometimes, like, for example, I said, oh, could we study Thessalonians? And she was saying, oh, that one's going to be, and it did cause a little bit of trouble in the group. And I think some people ended up leaving the group.
Right.
But I could just see, like, we looked at the day of the Lord in 1 Thessalonians 5, and I didn't really understand what that was. And then that started me studying for myself, along with being mentored by her, but also seeing for myself all the connections throughout the whole Bible, and understanding the day of the Lord was basically the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD. And that, you know, that was the final, the judgment there. So Yeah, so I could just see, like, basically how the Bible interpreted itself, how, because when you start studying things in context, it just explains itself. And
yeah, it's remarkable that way, isn't it? And when you're taught by other people, they give you these filters that you filter the Bible through. Have you noticed that each stage that you were in, or that I was in my life, we were taught to look at the Bible through a particular frame of reference. And so everything we saw, I think Doug Wilson says it best. Of course, he says it negatively about full preterists, but he says, if you have a hammer, everything that you see is a nail. And I like how he put it that way, because when you think about that in the Bible, like, for example, if you're thinking of futurist things, then when you look at that Bible and you read those futurist things, it makes you think, oh, this is going to be things in my future. Whereas when we look at things with past, sometimes we look at those things in the past. However, what I've discovered is that if you just let the Bible interpret itself, if you just let it tell you what things mean and interpret itself, it will reveal itself. It reveals itself in the text. It shows you.
Totally. It totally
does.
You
just have to turn. You have to turn these things off in our head. We have to filter. We have to change that filter. Just let it do it. It's hard. It's very hard to do that.
It is hard to do, but I agree. I think sometimes you have to be able to sort of just put aside your preconceived ideas. Just put it aside. How the filter or the lens through which you have looked at everything so far, maybe that's wrong. Put aside and look at with fresh eyes and think about the original audience. And that was a huge game changer to me. It's funny because most people, if you talk to them and you'll say context is important, original audience is really important, and most people will agree with you. Yes, of course it's important. But when I was studying with my sister Elise, and I began to really consider original audience relevance, and began to see the time statements and things like that. And that helped me to see what did Paul actually mean when he wrote that or said that to the people to whom he said it? Or what was Jesus actually talking about back in the first century when he said that? Rather than seeing it through a denominational lens or through someone else's teachings, what someone else taught hundreds of years ago that meant. You know what I mean? Like, over hundreds of years, various doctrines have built upon one another, and then most people tend to see the Bible through those doctrines, through that lens, rather than look at the Bible with fresh eyes. But like you say, it can be, it's very challenging to completely just put aside your preconceived ideas. That's that thing called cognitive dissonance.
Yes, yeah. And it's very hard to divorce ourselves, divorce our minds from what we already have placed in there. And that's one of the reasons that I actually started the podcast was a friend of mine and I wanted to sit down and just read the Bible and try to understand it. And you know, it's really hard to do that too because we don't know the original languages. We don't know the cultures. We can read the Bible and pick up on specific cultures, but we don't necessarily understand the full surrounding cultures and how they influenced Israel and, things that the prophets would say, you know, like the sun will be darkened. You know, for us, we think of things so literally in America that it's hard. It's hard to read prophetic language or apocalyptic language and actually understand it. So that's where we needed the most help. And so we just understood, all right, let's put aside these presuppositions. Let's put aside these preconceived ideas. And let's see if we can learn what the Bible is saying, even if we need external resources like ancient Near Eastern culture, like archaeology. We've looked through a lot of things. And by doing that, it's helped us get a new frame of reference. And the audience relevance, it's wonderful in the New Testament, but a lot of times we don't use it in the Old Testament, and we need to. We've got to go way back. We got to be audience relevance to the audience of Genesis and to the audience of Exodus, right? when this was written. And also when you're reading Daniel, it's easy for us to connect Daniel to Matthew or to, you know, to talk about the end times, but there's so much within Daniel, so much Babylonian culture, so much things that, you know, you can even pick up covenant within the stories of Daniel or the stories of Esther or, you know, kinds of the things. So it's hard as an American to do it. You really work hard at it.
You do have to work hard. And unfortunately, I think in most church groups, the people become quite passive and they end up just sitting there and listening to whatever's dished up to them. But you, to come to these understandings, you have to dig for yourself and you have to put in a bit of work. But there's so much to learn, so much to understand. Like you say, understanding the language and the meaning of the language that was used in the Bible. What's really important, I think, is like you're talking about the Old Testament, actually digging into the Old Testament to understand the New too. And that's something I think I'd neglected the Old Testament a lot. But if you want to understand, especially say Revelation, you have to get into like the prophets and you have to get your head around the use of language. And like you say, usually most people, they read the Bible and they think everything's literal and physical when sometimes there's figurative language.
Right. There's other things too, like chiastic structures, things that we can't see because we're not writing in Hebrew. Right. Mm-hmm. Or that is, you know, that there's a chapter in Daniel that's written in Aramaic. Why? You know, things that we wouldn't know. We wouldn't know that because we only know English and we read our English versions. But we've learned these things by digging, like, oh, so there is a chapter written in Aramaic. There's one. And why? That's really interesting. And then to come to particular places in the prophets and realize that it's actually poetry. It's poetry. Not all of it, but some of it is poetry. And you're like, we don't understand it. Or Hebrew idioms. We can't pick up on the idioms in our English Bibles. The only way we can look them up is to research and find out, oh, that's actually a Hebrew idiom. And this is what it means. You know, it's a lot of hard work. And by the way, we're called the Burros of Berea. Burros, because we're jackasses, we're donkeys, and we're stubborn. And Berea, because we are like the Bereans in Acts chapter 17 that search the scriptures to see if what was said to us is true. That's what we want to do. And it is not an easy thing. You have to be willing to work hard and put a lot of effort in and take some shots in the head. People don't like it when for us, like we come to these understandings and we feel pretty strongly about them. And some people don't like it even because it differs from the creeds or it differs from orthodoxy. And it's not because we're just trying to be obstinate. It's because we simply see it in the scripture and we've studied a lot about it.
Yes, that's right. I suppose that's part and parcel of sharing truth and putting it out there, is that you are going to get negative comments. You're going to have people disagreeing with you and saying all sorts of things on social media about you. And that is hard to take at times. So I don't like to get into arguments with people or debates, especially if they have a go at me because I'm a female teaching. I kind of think, oh, what's the point of even trying to argue with this person because they won't listen to anything I say because I'm a female. So
right.
Just let them go. But
it's very common where I live, you know, about women not being able to teach, and I've had several people argue with me about it. Oh, I don't care what they say. Because of my eschatological position and where I believe that we stand today, it's released me a lot of things that Paul was really concerned about during his time in ministry. He was there for a specific time, and he knew it, and he knew when he was removed that ravenous wolves were going to come in and start disrupting. He was very aware of it, so he took care to teach Titus and Timothy particular understandings knowing that the end was near, and that once that happened and we had all of it, that now there is therefore no more Jew or Greek and bottom. That is the world we do live in. Paul is the one that said that, you know, so Paul said that, and Paul also said the other things. So only because I hold to a fulfilled eschatology did my mind change in regard to women teaching, because otherwise, looking future wise, like Paul was, he said, I don't allow a woman to teach a man. I mean, he said it. What else do you want to hear? But why? The importance is why he said it and when he said it and to whom he said it. That's beyond section. And so that's where I'm at. So teach away, lady. I'm all about it.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Yeah.
In case you needed my permission, I've given it to you.
There you go. Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yes.
So that's where you are now. So you have a YouTube channel. And like I said, guys, I'm going to put it in the show notes. And I'm also going to put the links to your talks at Eschaton 2025 there in Sydney. And Brother Al Prasone, it was so kind to put all that up. So I'm going to send links there, guys, for you to look at it. And so let's talk about your future. I don't know if you were done with your testimony. I mean, you're in full preterism at this point, right?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty much up to date with everything there. I've I came to an understanding slowly over a few years of completely fulfilled eschatology. I think that up until I was mentored by Elise and her husband, I didn't have the full picture in my head. I didn't really understand it. But then I slowly, as we're studying the Bible together, I came to a full understanding of fulfilled eschatology. And that it was probably about 3 years ago that I realized the book of Revelation was not at all futuristic. Mm-hmm. Even Revelation 20 talks about resurrection and white throne judgment, that even that has already happened.
Right.
It's wild, isn't it? So that's where I'm at now. Yeah.
So what are you going to continue to teach on your YouTube channel?
Yes. So right now what I'm working on is putting up videos about the book of Revelation, and I'm trying to work my way through the whole book, but it's quite a big job. I think I'm about halfway through, and I really want to finish that off. I need to finish that off. And then I've got some ideas that are formulating in my head about what it all means and how the first few chapters of Genesis are even connected to the final four chapters of Revelation. It's basically the final four chapters of Revelation are the first three chapters of Genesis, but in reverse.
Mm-hmm. It's like chiastic. Decreation. It's almost like it's one gigantic chiastic structure. Yes. I wonder if anybody could put that together in the Bible and come to Isaiah 66, and that would be the center, which would make total sense how that would come.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you've ever seen that. But anyway.
So I'll get through this series of Revelation, and then I want to put together my other thoughts on paper and then create a series on that, and hopefully be able to offer that to people as a PDF or something like that, that they can just download. And from there, I'm not sure where I'll go, but that is my goal at the moment.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I have really enjoyed getting to talk to you, and it was a blessing to see you at that conference. I enjoyed what you taught, especially on those parables, and I just keep doing what you're doing and keep sharing the truth and the love of God with people. It was a blessing to me. That's why I wanted to meet you. That's why I wanted to talk to you. So I'm glad that Brother Al allowed that to happen.
Yes. Oh, thank you, Rick. Yeah, it was actually Dawn Stead that invited me to talk there, like you. Same with you.
She invited me. Yeah, she invited me too. Yep. And I hate that I wasn't there. I was, like I said, I think I told you this before with the recording, is I was supposed to be in Adelaide. My wife actually has a friend that she taught in school with that lives in Adelaide now. And so we were going to go visit her, and I was going to try to visit my friend Nigel while we were there, but wasn't able to. But Nigel's coming here. He's actually coming here from Adelaide in the fall. And so I'll get to see him.
Oh, and wow.
Very excited about that.
That's so good.
Well, so I'm going to ask you to just hang on after we end this recording, because I want to chat with you, okay?
Okay.
Thank you so much for being on the Birds of Bree. It means a lot to me.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you very much.
What if your self-help coach was your captor? What if empowerment meant obedience, and a colored sash meant you belonged to someone? This is the true story of Nexium, a personal development company that promised growth and delivered control. We're going inside the minds behind the headlines. Keith Raniere, the so-called genius who weaponized belief. Nancy Saltzman, the therapist who professionalized submission. And Allison Mack, the actress who helped brand women into silence. We'll hear from survivors, whistleblowers, and the families who fought to bring the truth to light. This isn't just a cult story. It's a case study in how ambition, psychology, and charisma can become chains. Listen to our new series of Sashes and Slaves, coming soon only on Patreon. Go to www.patreon.com/theburrowsofberea.